Carried Out, A Course Correction by Anja Ottler, translated from the German by Kurt Beals.
Erstes Blatt. Hier. Offene Flächen inmitten der Feldflur. Ich habe sprechen wollen mit Ihnen. Und wenn ich zeichne, reichen die Bäume aus ihren weichen Spitzen, Astscharen und aus ihnen heraus sie hell auf einigen Rücken reißen, sie weisen in die Luft und mich, ich habe und treibe sie aus. Dann bleiben zurück für uns Einzelne dunkel, wir haben uns endlich berührt.
Second leaf, radiant joy. That it would have grown into a stone. Me in the bright dress, girl. He has fur, he moves, and when it gets too cold, he's a watchdog. Never? They dress me brightly, so people can see you in the dark. I'm never outside in the dark. In the afternoon, I go behind the shed all summer, behind the woodpile, squeeze in between the wire fence and the boards. Into the shadows, the shed presses itself into my back, still like scratches at wire for the stones, a late scent that lingers all night. Wood. There I am, beyond the fence is the kennel, that's where he's lying. I come as a simple stirring of the afternoon. I've been coming here so long, I think. We know nothing more than me, a shaky spot, pale, a washed out scraping from the mechanics of the day. Like the unclear line of metal on the tongue before the owner brings the water in the evening. Then I'd already slipped from the field, a faint reflection of the morning light that pours in every day, a cutting blade but quickly faded by the shadows, the darkness of eye, fur, fades into itself. And I too dive into the dense web of black, gray, and brown. He doesn't look at me. I turn to follow his gaze, stamp the ground firm with my eyes, across the few stones, stretch of sparse grass. It's a short way to the wall in front of his face, and he fades into the shack, the wires, the wall in his eyes. He lies calmly, a barely breathing rift, fur rippled as if it all overlapped, and nothing. Around the corner of the house, signs of stirring, and I'm stamped out, sprung out, a flickering ball caught and flashing. This afternoon, there's nothing I have to do there. Then many years of ordinary time. I'm loose and free, never think of those afternoons, and rarely of that too warm night, quiet behind the second-story glass. Two streets, they cross in the floodplain, the dog criss-crossing them. The moon helps him rise, his back climbs as a line of light up to the high-voltage wires, shoots. These clusters of smells dance a crisscross for this one nose. This one time it reaches in, stick it in once, rip it, mount it, piss on it, that he doesn't cry out. For many minutes it's all too quiet. The overhead wires hum a normal night. He had to be shot. That I might see, first plea. Such... For the first time, such stone, a black-baked bowl, and the nails go to work on it fast so that a dry rain rustle from the pit patters so that I crackle like the run, so it rushes the air that it rakes me up, all the fur from the rushing claws here, claws it up into the ears, fills them, fills, rustle through the stroop. The muzzle, one such rushing air, such onward movement in the tongue, the teeth too, for the eyes they stretch far out, so that we all, far out, so that it lies behind now, almost lost, left there by the lair, by the muzzle, what a fifth arm, already it's pressed to the, it goes, rips all the skin open once more, a blast, blend, fragments, drops and air, from the sudden foreign body come, alas, said that itself is
fest hier. Und wenn ich zeichne, there is nothing but white. Zeichne nicht mehr und habe lang nicht gedacht daran. Ich tue nichts weiter, stehe, Das Fenster, die Füße am Boden, Dielen, das Fensterbrett unter den Händen, fest und der Nacken, die Schultern, schaue hinaus. Zur einen Seite hin Schotter, der Anger, der Damm, auf der anderen,
wie es sich wenden kann,
und zieht mich zu. Ob sie weiß, wie sie mich herausgenommen mit ihrer Frage und mich gesetzt, wo ich allein, dass ich auf sie warte, Wiederkehr, ihre Zwangsläufigkeit wie das Frühjahr, so lässt sie mich jetzt, so lässt sie mich jetzt mit den Tagen und Dielen dem Kopf, wo etwas reglos sich breitet und einradiert in die Lippen tut, warte, hole dorthin die wenigen Sachen von früher, halte sie da. Wie am Fensterbrett leere Insektenpanzer darin zu stochern, nach Resten von guten Larven such, unter den Sitzen und Stehen berühren, wo ich mit mir, wo ich mich noch aufgehalten habe. Es muss da mehr sein als weiß. Es ist Frost. Ein Mosaik Nadeln, einzelne Blätter, mehrere Zentimeter dicht. Der Boden tritt in sie über, sie nehmen sich Wasser. Es streut Licht. Fest hier. Und wenn es mir abschreiben, dass da die Blätter und drunter ich, werde ich schneller schreiben müssen, wo so früh immer Frühling ist, rasche Passagen machen, erinnern, wie nach einem Steinschlag die Brocken abgehen, darauf steigen, kurze Knöchel gegen den Fels, was für grobe Kraft, das aus langer Zeit und aus den Schatten vermahlene Blätter, leere Segmente, Insekten, was hat es nicht ausgehalten? Was hat sich getan? Von da ein paar Sätze zusammenkriegen, ein paar Sätze zusammenkriegen, die aushalten. Solche, die sich leichter legen, sie werden sich nicht ohne Ohnmacht, aber vielleicht kann es lockere schlingen, damit ich aus kann, bevor wieder sie und diese Frage Zellen streuen, an die ich die Augen dann kleben kann, die mir die Augen verkleben dann an den wenigen Tagen, ehe der Frost fällt, ein Tag Frühling, ein zweiter und drei und zu spät, denn es ist eigentlich einfach gesagt. Ich, weiblich 43, habe niemand getötet. Ich habe eine Waffe genommen und mit ihr die Leute, einige weiblich jung, für wenige Stunden heraus aus dem leisen Pochen der Schritte ihrer kaum abgefädelten Zeit. Ich wollte sie alle. Aber eine gewiss habe ich damit zur Welt gebracht, auf andere, dünnere Sohlen gesteckt. Jetzt setz den Fuß in das sandige Grubenfleisch. Etwas wird haften an dir, es wird durch dich treiben und vergessen nichts. Unsere kurze Fahrt in die Kiese, Geröll, auch unsere Reifen hinein in die Flanke des bröckligen Bergs, aufgegraben, gefressen und dort nur sie herausgebeten und ein Schuss pro Reifen nach ein paar Sätzen hineingewispert ins plötzlich gehäutete Ohr. Du bist Beifang, Herzchen, du, meine Schöne, ihren Arm an die Brust, Kopf an Metall gedrückt, abgedrückt, klick, auch sie hört es. Leer. Und bis sie zurückfanden aus ihrer Angst in die Glieder, jetzt kannst du gehen, frei, war ich schon ein, war eine der dunklen Schlangen der feuchten Arme aus Sand, ihren leichten Schrittes zu folgen für ein sicheres Stolpern nach Haus, dass sie ankommen, dieses eine für allemal. So viel zu wissen, fürs Tun hat's gereicht über alle Jahre. Schnelle Sätze und Haufen Zahlen waren grob, waren rohe Stiche, mit denen konnte ich die Glieder vernähen, welche mir auseinanderfahren wollten, vernähen. Und ein grober Stich braucht ein rasches Tun, Tun voran, dass die drinnen hören von sich, wir, erkenntliches Wir, wo sie sonst, wie aus Holz gemacht, wie aus Stein oder Metall gemacht, stumm mir auseinander fürs Aufhören, das alles aufhören, wenn man aus dem Tritt fällt und fällt, sich irgendwo halten, dass nicht der Kopf schon zu wenden und Damm und Dielen erst seine Leere hinter den, dafür reicht es nicht. In diesem plötzlichen Sitzen, lange und Stehen, wie lang, bis ich mich traue.
Fixed here, but the cottage is well chosen, All the way at the edge of a plot of small gardens, a train track behind, where it curves a small mound of gravel and steel, the garden colony turns and thins out, runs out onto a sharp point of land, a cottage, this one, mine for these few weeks, where the road, a residential street further down to the south, ends. And one of those fields of low, hard scrub brush runs across this road towards the east and the river, runs up to the stub of a road from the north, runs into it, a certain wrong turn, a side road that lies undisturbed, listening beneath its own crust. How near the seeping water is pressing in from the banks, how high it is rising today on the outstretched, frozen yellow stems, grasping, churning, how deeply the crystals are already cracking. And the fallow field runs north to a fence just beyond that, a warehouse. As long as I've been here, I haven't seen a single person by that fence, by the warehouse. No one, not even walking a dog. The people stay close to their homes, to the strips of grass around the asphalt, garages, talk there too, but don't venture out onto this fallow field that ends in a small grove to the east, the usual bank growth, willows, poplars, nettles, a few alders, and a lot of shrubs that I could trace but not name. And amid that, the river, fathomless nearlessness, from right here, was able to draw a small piece of it. That was long ago, from a tiny piece of time.
Count off.
Late
kennel,
February.
Kennel, finger,
everything
temple.
Else. Attempts. Love. Nothing. And it's very good for me to be here. Carefree. I won't leave here again. The city isn't so big that many people are looking for places to sleep in the winter. In the north, there are more warehouses with dumpsters. Enough food thrown out every night. I already still want there to be less of me, and when I go there, people aren't coming and going. Two or three times I went into the small city. I don't want to go again. So the days are quiet. I look, and of course, the fear. But tomorrow, when it's dark, I'll bury the gun behind the house. I won't shoot myself. In the small strip between the western wall and the railway embankment where the ground is sandy. Sometimes someone will want to plant something there. We'll try it, find it, think it still works, pull the trigger, and kill something just as a test. I still have the knife anyway. But clearly even that can't help me cut away the sounds, and so there's the new dread. She, of course, must already know where I am. Like I'm blind here,
she could already
though I could see so well, unfold it all, take it apart, and put it in order from the corner
heart,
of my eye,
like this
every
question,
moment, every bump,
what should I,
of shadows.
That question that even I couldn't bear. I.
And how could I have known that my eyes need the sound, too? That's what etches the lines into them. Even if no one has ever hollowed out the rustling and crackling sounds, the rubbing of leaves and stones the way that she has, so that she could roll herself up in them close and closer and suddenly break out, an audible step, is there. Already an arm around my neck, hard chest on my shoulder, mouth pressed to my right ear, said what she had to say. Unfortunately,
how things can turn, no, it's your night already, now, now I tell
you. And now you have time, and now think. I'll come on the third day of spring, if you know when that is, to get my answer. And by the time I came back, she was already somewhere. No, of course she will keep her word. It wasn't an early spring day yet. It's not January yet. Not even December. And I'll observe all the days, soak up all their scents, and put them in order. We'll count them. The first day will come, then another, and then. And until then, I'll concentrate. Stay calm, still free throughout these days. And when the gravel doesn't gleam behind the house, when the walls of my veins push together in the cold, I will help myself out, will be restless.
Adrenaline Memory by Melina Kamadich, translated by Jennifer Zobel. Sometimes my memory is like a film in slow motion, so slow that it gets stuck on a single image. Other times, it's so fast that color and sound blur together. I remember the occasional odor of fear, the uncertainty of shivering skin, I remember the feeling, and almost nothing else. I've been wandering around for days and asking if anyone remembers what he or she was doing on May 2nd, 1992. I ask only those who I know for sure were living in my reality. I'm not interested in the ones who can tell me about refugee housing in Zagreb, or those whose stories begin, "When we were at war in Dubai, we almost got killed by the heat." No, I won't ask them. I ask the ones like me who instantly were changed. Those who learned that only cold water washes out blood. Those who, though they rarely talk about it, feel their stomachs turn when they hear the crackling of fireworks. Those who know that life is not life until you smell death. Everyone remembers the date, the day, the hours of the day. Someone was in the basement. Someone looked at a tank through a gun sight. Someone learned that first day what it's like when someone who belongs to you dies in war. My mother says, "How do you not remember? That day we watched the planes bombard Hum, and then Branka called from Belgrade, asked how we were, and asked whose planes. And I said to her, 'Well, who has the planes, Branka? The UNA.' Branka cried then, and Piva came onto the line and said, 'Yes, we know who's doing this to you. Be careful, and give my regards to Pedro.' 'How come you don't remember?' And then my mother says, 'You see, they never spoke again, Papa and Piva. And now there's no more Papa or Piva.' I'm silent. I don't remember. I'm sitting on my laptop screen, news footage from Dnevnik, the May 2nd, 1992 broadcast. Through the headphones, I hear Senad, "Were you shot at from the tram, General?" Then the recording trails off. The trams burn in Skenderia. I'm lying down, eyes closed. Let's remember what you did. Remember. Dnevnik comes on. Ganic says, "Alija, this isn't about you. It's about the state of Bosnia and Herzegovina. The state is being held captive." "Remember, girl. Slowly. What you did. Did you go to the base?" "Certainly. The day before that, you'd become a member of the Omer Malic battalion." "What did you do?" "Come on. Slowly. What did you eat? You must have eaten. Who did you talk to? Who did you have coffee with? Come on. Remember." I'm lying down, eyes closed. The 2nd of May, 1992. An ordinary day, 24 hours. The parallel reality erased by adrenaline. 16 years later, lying with my eyes closed, I remember almost nothing. Only this. That day, for the first time in my life, I lit a cigarette in front of my late father. Not in front of him, with him. My memory is reduced to an image, his hand holding a match to the Trina cigarette between my lips. And even then, only the outline of the image. The knowledge that after that day, after what began then, I would never be the same.
This is Sandra Kolankevich reading De Soto and the Pigs. Yes, we went up there. Ike. Babies sucked openly, mothers showing themselves, the men so foolish they tossed back crayfish bearing eggs. How could they benefit from letting us see their women? We drove the swine through their corn stalks, the banks filthy where they rooted. Better to cover them up. Best to leave a wife at home, silk and pearl sewed into her lace, than to see 2 years later the rib cages, tall grasses between them like plumes, ulnas and femurs scattered, skulls opened and turned toward the light, the few pigs that had escaped us gone feral, so quick our dogs couldn't catch them.
Please consider forever what you have said. An artist built a box, and while he was building the box, cutting the pieces of wood, fitting them together, measuring and sanding, later nailing, he made a recording of his work. Then, probably after some time passed and many conversations, hard work or hard luck, he put the box in a show in the Green Gallery. Inside the box, playing in loop, was the recording of the making of the box. And one wonders whether, while listening to the sounds, the box was sad. Now, if you're the type of person who does not believe a box could be sad, you should stop listening now, for surely your time would be better spent contemplating a book on carpentry or measuring the average height of the blades of grass on your lawn. It may be true that the box will have a life longer than the tree it came from. That is, longer than the tree it came from if the tree was never cut down in the first place to make lumber, for houses, for coffee tables, for plain, simple boxes. Perhaps the box was sad at night when the lights of the gallery were snapped off, the doors shut, locked, or perhaps this was the only time the box was happy in its new state, listening to the sounds of its own making, because the darkness reminded the box of the dark of the forest at night, and it could even convince itself that the sound of the saw was the sound of its own leaves rubbing against each other in the breeze, which sounded nothing like the part about the hammering, which didn't hurt as much as you may think, and, like stitches, contained a hope of wholeness in the pain. Some have said that the recording reveals art as mere carpentry. Some have said the box is a Marxist statement. Others that the recording is the box's memory. The artist said it's a way of both splitting and joining process and object. The box, of course, listens to the sounds of its own making and has had to listen to what viewers say of it. In this way, it is much like the polar bear at the zoo. Sometimes one viewer leans towards another and says, "Uninspired, uninspiring," as if the bear or the box has no way to hear this, understand it. The box, of course, has made some viewers cry, and the box immediately understands these tears as tears of deep comprehension, connection, and concern. I cannot tell you what you should say to the box should you come across it displayed in a room, tucked in the corner of a studio, in transit from one to the other. But I should like to advise you to whisper. Karen Karsha. Karen Karsha. Stereopsis. Soon the work of winter will begin. That is, the small, tough work of a man wading out into snow that covers the height of his boots, to brush and scrape and prepare a way into the world, by which I mean the man will clean off a car. But now we're inside, where the first thing of note that happened was my breaking a beer bottle in this man's kitchen. Who knows why my brain didn't notice that the undue force of my arm moving the full teapot from sink to stove would nick the edge of the dark brown bottle. It was morning and an accident. And, so you don't get the wrong idea, though the counter was full, it only had two beer bottles on it, next to a collection of dirty dishes waiting from last night's supper, hoping to be rinsed and scraped themselves. Of course, the work of winter may be something entirely different. In the case of winter, it may consider its work to be the beautiful stillness of not just forests and fields, but once busy streets. Or perhaps it has something to do with hibernation and seed pods. Even for this man, cleaning off a car is not much work, but it leads to other work and is, for us, necessary. And perhaps the accident of force, the breaking of the bottle, is nothing, not noteworthy at all, except for the fact that I've noted it here twice. Perhaps the most noteworthy thing hasn't happened yet. The small sliver of dark brown glass that the brush and pan did not scoop up, that later will insert itself in the paw of a mouse who squeezed in to get away from the cold. And yet, this small injustice will go unnoticed by us, so distracted from trying to catch a mouse. Sunday School. In the beautiful story, heavily edited, we learn of skeletons that never tire. We learn stories that we cannot unfold, like our fortune-telling paper cootie catchers, which delight in their proclamations of, you have a secret admirer, something you have long wished for will soon come true. We learn of those who rejoice with loaves of bread and two cakes, and those who rejoice by releasing one prisoner and hanging another. We dream of rain on the roof of a cottage chamber bed, of a blanket of air woofed and woven. We're not sure if scourge is a whip or some plague, but we know that both cause suffering, as do questions about grammar. We learn that although gleaning sounds so beautiful, sounds like flowing gowns and listening intently, it has mostly, in the telling of the beautiful story, to do with wheat, which, although in illustration itself looks like the folds of a dress bending in a gentle breeze, means work under sun, and we already know what that is like from the time we uproared about why Jesus cursed the fig tree and were told to weed St. Francis's garden, which was planted but not tended by the second grade CCD class. We learn how to interpret the dream in which your own heart is replaced with that of a beast of the field, and we know silence before news suggests its import. We learn that even though the beautiful story entails famines and horrible punishment and revolt and battles and slavery and sin and sin and sin, we are supposed to be interested in the parts about the dedication of the temple and forgiveness and Jesus preaching by the seaside, and when he finally turns the water into wine, we've already been ourselves corrupted a bit, and we're looking for patterns in the heavy ornamentation of the once gilded, now faded, golden and red design on the sides of each page, and we think we see the word Beelzebub hidden in the scroll work of the title page, and are thinking of what type of raiment we would wear if at Halloween we could go as Esther, and how it would feel to be a sheep when the angel comes to tell the shepherds that Jesus is born, and how it would feel to be the water under the feet of a man who can walk on it without sinking. How it would feel to be water. Karen Karsha, The Arc of the Story. 1. The narrator says, only the silence is with us, and then the night gets a little colder. But we do not feel alone because the silence is with us, and there is no light, only darkness within the darkness. Imagine walking the uneven terrain, a graveyard at night, with just that blue light, the snow endlessly reflecting out, just enough to see by, not enough to make the walking hard, just enough to, here and there, make out the names, Vesta May Denro, Emmanuel Finch, Essex Miller, Holland Pike, just enough to think about the ways we die, strung out, stung by bees, calling out to those who love us and those who don't, or not calling out at all, just struck dumb, in awe, just struck. 2. Of course, when the narrator says that about the silence, you take my hand in the dark of the theater. We look for an instant at each other and then up over the rows to the screen. The light from the projection booth illuminates the tiny particles of dust we're breathing in and out. 3. And after the movie, life for a moment. It's 2 a.m. and the humid night shining yellow under the streetlights of Wadsworth Avenue. We've all wandered down to the lake and wade right in, clothes on, a momentary relief. We all breathe for this moment before. 4. The way it ends, car wrecks, drownings, drawing in the last snow-filled breath into the silent lungs, the last luminous gliding, stopped, which the narrator, not having been through it, can only describe as darkness within, darkness. Karen Karsha, 2. If there is such a term as the ever after, then why not call this the ever before? It is indelibly before what comes next. Consider this. A man is walking out of a hat store. He has no hat. He has just ordered a hat. It is new and beautiful, felt, brown because he likes the rich tone. He feels so satisfied. Even though his wife will complain, he feels so satisfied. So what if brown doesn't match his coat? He likes it. And shouldn't there be more celebration in the world? Shouldn't he eat pancakes for dinner if he wants? Maybe he will paint the house red, as his youngest wants. Who cares? Throw a party. Call the sitter. Get a tooth pulled. This man, he has not really come out of a hat shop, because how many hat shops have you ever seen? Not many. A few, perhaps. If lucky, two. This man has no hat, or has a hat that is already sufficient, and he is not thinking of anything except meatloaf. And although you have eaten succulent meatloaf, a swirl of meatloaf filled with spinach or stuffing or meat, often meatloaf is nothing but dry and sad, sitting in a glass pan placed next to canned string beans that are soggy and lukewarm. You know well this meatloaf of closets. This is the meatloaf of the hat man, and he is sad, like mashed potatoes, indelibly so.
From Blind Spot, from Part 1, Hotel, 7. The deceptions of ghosts, or not of ghosts, or not of anything at all. It was peace that sustained the war, a matter of oppositions. And in that discontinuity, that continuity, because it was reversible, he stood and watched as the other guests entered the hotel. They, the other guests, entered the hotel through the lobby, a never-ending stream. And there was home to think about as well, a thought as definite as any other. The moment he left his room, and this trouble, really troubling thoughts, when there was something at stake, some matter of honor or another, something specific to the war or to war in general at least. It was in the room that these thoughts occurred to him, provoked him, tiny thoughts, not even the thoughts he'd intended to consider. And there was a kind of absolute silence spawned by, perhaps, a deepening sense of victory, or rather of entitlement. And yet, there was no stage, no stage specifically, nor even a place for the guests to go and be entertained. Still they, the other guests, seemed to eat a lot. In the garden. There was a seat in the garden. There were several seats beside him in the garden. It was a beautiful day. The sun was out and the birds were singing in the air. A home in the forest, so to speak. And all men require a home in the forest. At one time, and those were seemingly days of greater purity, men lived in the forest. There was no violation. There was no particular code of honor that had to be followed. It was simple, really. The men, the other guests, lived in the forest for a time, and then they left and continued with their lives, their businesses, their personal development, and so on. It is in this way that the days continue. He is alone in a hotel. This is neither a break nor a vacation, not exactly. He is on assignment. He is at the hotel for a specific reason, or he is on leave for a specific reason. In either case, he is not living his usual schedule, not performing his usual tasks and duties in their usual ways, nor at their usual times. In fact, he has had to call home. His vacation has lasted longer than expected, and this situation, his condition, the condition he finds himself in, has already caused unimaginable problems for the world at large. It has already caused a great deal of consternation and pain and suffering. And luck, or ill luck, or bad omens have had nothing to do with it. It is pain. There once was pain. He is lying in his bed in his hotel room. It is a perfect night. He is high in the mountains. The air is sweet and the atmosphere is ideal. All his pain will be absorbed by the mountain air. The aroma, the simple smell of trees and of flowers, living flowers and of air, clean air, will help heal him of all that ails him. It is this benefit, one among many that the hotel offers, that the hotel is, in fact, famous for. He remembers this fact. The memory of this fact comes to him suddenly. It is something that pulls at him while he drives the car, or rather while he is driven in a car. The hotel he is to visit will be beneficial for him. Then the car breaks down. There is a problem with the car and he has to pull over to the side of the road. That is, the driver has had to pull the car over to the side of the road. The car is large, but it appears to be in good condition, if a little old and not quite in the current style or fashion. There is a pen in his hand and he is about to write a letter. He has just finished writing a postcard. There is a certain anticipation as the car winds its way up the mountain road, a certain sense of curiosity as the car approaches the hotel. The hotel is large and laid out in a very complex way. There is a real, almost indescribable complexity to the way the hotel is laid out. And, in fact, he is not sure at first that he belongs in such a fashionable place or among such exclusive company. The hotel is very elegant and very famous for its proximity to certain curative regions, specific areas that seem to cure people of what ails them. The hotel is beautiful and expensive, and the guests generally stay there for a very long time, often for multiple seasons. As he stands and watches the other guests enter the hotel, he is aware of how easily they are accommodated, how easily the hotel in its massive size and complexity is able to absorb them, other guests who arrive in a never-ending stream and then no sooner seem to disappear. This is the miracle of the hotel, of all hotels, of this hotel in particular. It is part of its mystery and fascination and charm. This information, of course, pertains to the old hotel, to the one that burned to the ground. Still, there is a question of trouble, specifically the trouble of blocking out certain stimuli. And the question becomes the hotel itself, or rather, it becomes a game he plays in the hotel. He is standing in the hall. He is standing next to a small table in the hall. There is a vase filled with flowers on the table. He is at his seat in the bar, the seat from which he is able to observe the lobby and the grand staircase. He is outside the lounge. He is in the lounge. He is in his room. He is eavesdropping on the guests in the room next to his. There is, of course, a form for all this, an unspoken language, and an unguessed-at consequence. And this consequence, of course, depends on his actions, on how and in what manner he will choose to carry himself. And this line of thinking inevitably leads to his next decision, the spontaneous decision that will propel events to their conclusion. It is already a conclusion of sorts that has just occurred, this meandering of his, this standing around the periphery of the hotel. He is standing in the hall, and this, too, has its consequences, a change that takes place unexpectedly, a rapid deployment of his qualities of service. There is, of course, much more to be said, and it also inevitably will be said at some point. But here it suffices to become the picture, the display, so to speak, of a kind and gentle turn of events, of a barely spoken of purpose, of points of fact, and then of their contraries. What occurs is occasional. There is a particular resistance on his part to contact, to unexpected social contact especially. And despite the weather had been nice, and despite the unseasonable and difficult weather, it is really the season that he finds himself responding to, that and particular voices, not so much their content, but the quality, timbre of the speech itself. And this causes something to change within him, a change of perspective that can only be characterized by its utter lack of perspective or of joy or of any other quality, positive or negative, that he can imagine. It just is what it is, and there is no telling what form it will take from one moment to the next. Essentially, it is in his power to make mistakes. It is his right to have come to this place in spite of his intention, of his clear intention. From part two, funeral. Three. There were icons in the backyard, not really icons, but things, objects, a collection of some sort, things, icons really. And the sight of it, that collection of objects, those things, objects, icons really, reminded him of death. It was late one night, really it was night and he was tired, but he didn't go to sleep. The idea of food bothered him, attracted him, and bothered him. He'd eaten in a restaurant, had earlier that night eaten alone in a restaurant, and the things, the collection of objects, the icons, the plants and trees and flowers, in the backyard and on the streets, everywhere, all of it, those things reminded him of death. There was a dog on the street. The dog was running down the street. The dog did not appear to be in distress in any way, yet still there was something about the sight of the dog that bothered him. It was a large event, an occasion, a funeral. There were many friends, associates, and relatives, and other people who stood in the open air that day. There was the sound of the eulogy and the sound of the prayers, the sound of crying. A body was being buried, interred. It was a solemn occasion, a funeral, an event that had required planning. There had been the threat of death for years, even the threat of death specifically on certain occasions. And there was something in his eye, something small, an object, something foreign, some foreign matter in his eye that, from time to time, bothered him. The sad part was that it was not a significant event. The funeral, in fact, was not a significant event at all. And still there was a question of waiting. There was waiting to be done, always plenty of waiting to be done. He'd waited for her by the door of the cafe. On another occasion, he'd waited for her on the street. On still another occasion, he'd sat and waited for her at a table in a restaurant. And then, in those days, he was usually on time or often early when he'd had an arrangement to meet with someone. The icons, the things, the collection of objects, the things, icons really, in the backyard reminded him of death. It had been months or years, it had been long, it had been a long time since he'd been in that neighborhood, in that part of the city, in the backyard at night. And there was more, there was, of course, much more to say about the situation, about all the situations he found himself in. But there was something in the way, a truck or car or bus, something, a vehicle of some sort was blocking his way. He was standing in the middle of the street, waving, gesturing, wildly, somewhat wildly, humiliatingly in a way, doing a kind of dance, almost a dance, trying to catch their attention. But there was something in the way. They, his friends, associates, enter the cafe through the front door, the door that faces the street. The day he'd waited for her had turned out badly. It was bad, a bad day. Yet it was a day, a period of time that he knew, somehow just knew, understood to be significant. In fact, he'd been aware that it, the day, the days, those days in general meant something. Still, he couldn't see any way of going back, of returning to where he'd been before. Things seemed to get worse after that, though he'd expected, had of course expected things to get better. He was waiting for her in the cafe or restaurant. It was late one night and he was tired, and at that point, anyone would have been tired. Still, there was no way of avoiding it, this fact, the signs. There was an open door, a green or red door. He walked through the open door and into a great room. The room was filled with light. It was filled with the most beautiful light he had ever seen. And there had to be something to fill the days. There had to be some miracle in the works, something. Something good was about to happen. He just knew it, or the way he looked as he stood, standing. And there are strict rules, laws, directives, strict prohibitions governing the handling of human remains. There were complications, however. Things happened unexpectedly, and the complications appeared or things changed literally overnight. He could see his friends, associates, turn the corner, approach the front door of the cafe. He waved, gestured wildly, somewhat wildly, humiliatingly in a way, did a kind of dance, almost a dance, trying to get their attention. There were icons, things, objects, a collection of some sort, things, icons really all around the backyard. It was night and dark, and there was very little wind. He was visiting a neighborhood, a part of the city. It was dark, very dark, much darker than he was accustomed to. He was standing in the backyard and there were various objects, icons, things, a collection of some sort, things, icons, really, hanging from beams and from walls and on the ground, wind chimes and small statues, a stone turtle and other things, objects, icons, really. His friends, associates, sat at the table in the cafe. And the cafe was very beautiful at that point. Still, there was something wrong or there was something missing. There was a feeling generally speaking, that there was something wrong, that something was in fact missing or even stolen perhaps. He sat and looked out the cafe window. He sat for a long time and stared out the front window of the cafe, the one that faced the sidewalk in the street. And it was not long after that, the funeral. It was early or late, and it was time for him to go. He had to leave his place. He left his place early or late, or it could have been at night or in the evening. He went to work. He was on his way to do his job. And on that day, things were indeed bound to change. Yet still at that point, there was time. There was still time. He had time then at that point, time to spare. He bought stamps and stamped a letter and put the letter in a mailbox. And then he'd gone to work, had gone to do his job. It was later that day. It was after work, and there were stamps in his wallet. He'd intended to take the stamps out of his wallet and put them away in a drawer. Yet each time he'd opened the drawer, opened his wallet. And that day had been a surprise. It was so unpredictable. The ways the day, any day, could possibly go. It was a collision of sorts, a violent collision on the street outside the cafe. And earlier that day, he'd waited for her on the street. He sat in the cafe or restaurant and waited. And there were others at the funeral, others, observers, recorders, if you will. And then there was the sound of glass breaking, the sound somewhere off in the distance, perhaps, of glass breaking. The icons, the things, the collection of objects, the things, icons really, in the backyard were made of wood and metal, mostly, or mostly made of wood and stone, or mostly made of plastic, or made of plastic and wood and metal and stone, and even ceramic and some glass. And there was no denying that something significant had happened, that indeed something had changed. He bought stamps in the morning on his way to work. In the meantime, there were arrangements, preparations to be made. It was a solemn occasion, a funeral, an event that had required planning. There was a dog on the street. There was a dog running down the street, and the dog was not in distress or did not appear to be in distress in any way. The dog ran up the street, seemingly carefree, in seemingly a carefree manner, yet still there was something sad in the way the dog ran. To him, there was a sadness, a real and profound sadness, in the way the dog ran up the street. Yet he was not typically one to feel sentimental over animals. He had no particular appreciation for animals, had never really paid that much attention to animals. There was a room, and he tried to see what the room looked like. There was a bed in the room, and a chair, and bookcases. Most likely the room he slept in, the room where he spent his time. He feels like the most likely answer is that he had happened upon the room where he slept, the room where he spent his time. It was difficult to see in the dark, however. But after staring at the room for a while, he was sure that it was the place. Still, at one time, he feels the room might have been slightly different, maybe painted a different color, or there might have been different furniture.
Joshua Daniel Edwin. Gruß vom Krampus. My home is a walk-in snuffbox heaped in alpine tumble snow. My fame has made life easy. Now I melt in among my brash pretenders. At Christmas time, so many crabby, widowed men in masks lope like drunken wolves through the half-lit, birch-whipped squares. I am dismissed as a relic of dusked superstition. A stopped pocket watch means someone's died. No one sees me tail the night parade, counting children with my hooded, bookish gaze. They let their window locks grow soft. My uncanny friend, the wind, elides my hoofprints from the snow-bright lawns. Joshua Daniel Edwin. In the Garden of Earthly Delights, after Bosch. Your reward is freedom. You can cannibal, cleave off ears, whittle with your brothers, eat long pig. String up the brunette, outstretch his ecstasy of arms, tight as harp wires, rake his stave of ribs, stuff the apple in his mouth. Shelter? In the whale oil lantern. Mortal sins punch your ticket here. Welcome to my fiefdom. As pride predicates a fall, your will prepares my meals. Joshua Daniel Edwin, during my reign, I balanced the palace like a grape in my palm. I kept hounds and lions chained to my raised and valenced bed. What use had I for fear? The golden honeybee, my heraldic charge, graced my nightgown, which I wore all day whenever I saw fit. Traveling, I perched in a violet, velvet-lined sedan, securely belted, my passing grumps and hungers palliated with fresh apples, the finest grains and cereals, all bagged and dusted with ground cinnamon, which was kept close at hand. Do you understand? I was the genius of this shore, the whole spanse of sea-blue carpet from the sofa to the small boudoir. I was the lone taproot to the verve that kept this great house thrumming, the piety of parents and child. Now children, now divided.
Pierre Menard's Alexander Bloch by Russell Scott Valentino. Editor's Foreword. Having relocated from Nîmes to Bexley, a region of Greater London that would be officially designated a borough of the city in 1965, it is known that Pierre Menard, notorious for his hitherto unsurpassed, if fragmentary, translation of the Quixote, took up the perfection of his Russian, abandoned since approximately 12 years before. In one of his surviving notebooks from this period, he complains, among other things, including of the wretched quality of the water and the even more wretched quality of the weather, that it was slow going at first without his beloved dictionaries and a certain unnamed grammar that he had apparently picked up second hand at the Central Market in Arles in the summer of 1913. Nevertheless, gifted and diligent as he was, after several months of intensive work, he turned his attention to the translation of poetry. Here below, several examples of his manner of work, characteristically, for those familiar with his previous output, a progression of sorts. These translations, if they can in fact be called that without too offensively stretching the term's historical usage, have as their source the well-known titleless lyric of Alexander Bloch, 1880 to 1921, that begins, «Девушка пела в церковном хоре», «A girl sang in a church choir». That he translated into English with some dexterity should not be surprising, given his background on his mother's side, and the fact of his relocation, albeit temporary, to England. Of particular note is the palimpsest quality of the final version, which contains hints and scratches of Bloch's original, though with the subtle alterations familiar from his lifelong, if largely hidden, work on the Quixote. I hope in the coming months to bring to light Menard's equally instructive versions of Velimir Chlebnikov, Marina Tsvetaeva, Osip Mandelstam, and others. R.S.V. Menard's Bloch, Version 1. A girl sang in a church choir of those grown tired in foreign lands, of ships sailed off to sea, of those who have forgotten joy. So sang her voice flying to the cupola, and the light shone on her white shoulder, and each looked and listened from the gloom, as the white dress sang in the light. To all it seemed there would be joy, that all the ships in peaceful bays, and all the tired folk in foreign lands, would find a bright and shining life. And the voice was sweet, the light was thin, and only high up in the heavenly gates, attached to mysteries, a small child wept, that no one would come back. Menard's Bloch, Version 2. A young girl was singing in a choir, of all the tired people in strange lands, of all the ships sailed out to sea, of all those who've forgotten their joy. Her voice sang flying up to the dome, and the light flickered on the white shoulder, and each looked and listened from the gloom, the white dress singing in the light. And to all it seemed that joy would arrive, with all the ships in a peaceful bay, and all the tired people in lands far away would find themselves a shining life. The voice was sweet, and the light slender, and only far up at the kingly doors, appended to secrets, a child was weeping that no one would ever come more. Menard's Block, version 3. Devushka singing in a church chorus of tired strangers in a stranger land, of all the vessels in the sea's forest, of souls forgetting all the joys of man. So sang Devushka, the notes rising taut, the lights shining through, shoulders gleaming white, everyone looking and listening fraught as the white dress held a note in the light. And joyous appeared in everyone's eyes the vessels, the ships, safe in quiet bays, and all the people, too, under foreign skies, having found their bright shining way. Devushka's voice sweet, shining light slender, and only high up at the kingly doors a little child wept, to secrets tendered, that of them all none would come back any more. Menard's Block, version 4. Devushka sang in церковном chorus of tired люди in чужом краю, of all корабли sailed off to sea, of всех forgetting радость свою. Так пел her голос, the notes rising up, и луч shining through on the white плече, and each из the мрака looked and слушал, как белое платье sang in луче. And to все it seemed that радость будет, что in safe havens все корабли, что на чужбине the tired out люди had their светлую жизнь набрели. The voice was сладок, shining light тонок, and только high up at the kingly врат, причастный to secrets, wept ребенок, что no one не придет назад. Menard's Block, version 5. Девушка пела в церковном хоре о всех усталых в чужом краю, о всех кораблях, ушедших в море, о всех забывших радость свою. Так пел ее голос, летящий в купол, и луч сиял на белом плече. И каждый из мрака смотрел и слушал, как белое платье пело в луче. И всем казалось, что радость будет, что в тихой заводе все корабли, что на чужбине усталые люди светлую жизнь себе обрели. И голос был сладок, и луч был тонок, и только высоко у царских врат, причастный тайнам, плакал ребенок о том, что никто не придет назад. Пьер Менард.
How We Stayed Together, A Graphic Flash, by Elizabeth Cadenis. We lost each other at 9 a.m. The phone rang, and you said, "My purple hair tie is lost somewhere between your sheet and your bedspread." I said, "I'll look for it." Then I imagined your hair unmoored, loose around your neck. I turned on the television and tried to read through the fuzz. A man was advertising an exercise machine that turned the woman modeling on a diagonal until the blood rushed to her head. I got tired of watching and dove like a crazy person into the sheets head first. I found your hair tie. I found your hair tie. I drove to you and returned your hair tie. The next night, you left your glasses. The next night, you left your laptop, 36 cents, then a book about travel, a lock, after that, underwear, later, a key, a black leather purse, a cell phone. I drove each object back. I would not let you buy a new version of something I could return to you so easily.
Junk Movements, Blue Raspberry. Who says you can't find a wholesome snack on the go? Mixed berry fruit crisps are made with real fruit wrapped in a sweet and crispy snack bar that's only 110 calories. Also, try apple cinnamon. This way, it can't be helped. She likes to think about it in this way exactly. the aggregate of his absences, the sweet sum of events and situations he had forsworn, would have made an ideal father, a wholesome golem of presentness, of being there, of being, of there. Hard to say why the emergency sprinkler brings her back to this course of thought, tinky thing embedded in the ceiling's porous institutional plaster, and rusting with leisurely calm. It crisps there, russet as an apple. Elbow one, propped behind head one, keeps it in her line of sight, eye one, eye two. Whereas elbow two is useless in the meantime, securely wrapped and gowned, pinned under ribs A1 through A12. She turns head one to ease the waiting, neck one panging only lightly in protest. Here are some things to read. That's something. Some specifications. Color. Latex-free. Size ounces. Blue. Yes. 8.5 ounces. 110. An unknown microscopic quantity of blue latex-free ounces is ghosting on breast two, evaporating from it. A cinnamon-brown hump. Imperceptible blue mist carried up from it to go find the ceiling, the crispy sprinkler. The energy of its dissipation is borne through the door as calories. Perhaps the evil little thing isn't exactly where she has testified. Perhaps it is a little more to the left or the right, below and above. The bar passes over here and also over there. Breast too, coated in blue. A nurse attached to the end of the bar purses everything on her face that can be pursed, then leaves. Earlier, the same nurse says, "But my God, you really are just a baby," tugging at the clipboard. She smells of a fruit splash, of the idea of mixed berry made real. She is kind and unsexed by her barrel scrubs. She is a blue raspberry, a beaker carrying tubes of fruit between machines that snack and try until there is a condition to find. Earlier, in the waiting room, with its chairs of jointed cherry wood and blunt pink damask, the receptionist says, "My God, you're just a baby," says, "Isn't she just a baby?" to the nurse. "Who?" says the nurse. Later, the nurse whispers to the doctor, "She's just a baby." By these rules, the doctor is also a baby. They stand in the hallway looking out at the waiting room, where there are women sitting on every surface, but no babies. Women cluster in packs near the closet full of gowns. Women sit on the worn pink chairs and watch the view. The doctor, whom no one notices as a baby, does not know that waiting rooms have always looked like this, tacky and neoclassical. Modernity has cycled through them and been found wanting. Modernity is in useful hiding. It loops through the machines as they grind and pulp inside their fruited reflections. This is what everyone, women and babies and doctors and nurses, is waiting for. We build neoclassical rooms to furnish its honor. The reflection signature reveals the medium when it chooses to do so. Unlike a baby's wail, it is beyond the naked ear to discern. Pocket. Warm, pillowy flatbread filled with seasoned ground beef, warm nacho cheese sauce, crisp shredded lettuce, and diced ripe tomatoes. You can also upgrade this item with marinated and grilled all-white meat chicken or authentic carne asada steak. All the birds roost at the back fence bar. Pillowy ripe hens, snowy in the face, coo at you like you're a chicken egg. All-white meat legs, warm as cheese, cased in dark seamed stockings looking grilled. Marked. For those not seasoned in husbandry, here's a ground rule. Beef up your ewe. Make it look authentic. Marinated man machismo dolloped on you like nacho sauce. Walk into the pub like a rubber monster, highballs rippling on the table. Steak looked at you from its warm plate and shredded itself. You'll tell all your grandbabies. No need for this fork and knife, but they place them there anyway, as a courtesy. Or how's that old John go? When you eat, it is the food that is scared. Big googly eyes looking nervous in your patty, peering out from underneath the seeded roll, a crisp frill of lettuce. French fries crying out in their bunch condition, bloodied with sauce. Down they go into your filled stomach, past your gulping neck, the telltale blink of your Adam's apple. Also, a shower of diced tomatoes, when it's carne asada night. In Bollywood flicks, there's a thing called an item number. Girl heretofore unintroduced gets up in spangles and a bare navel, Cleopatra eyes, with all her suggestions uncovered, then shakes her thing for a song. She's only allowed playback lyrics in a can for a voice, and in a husky alto at that. It's a difficult thing, glittery silo, hard to upgrade to real acting from there. wrap a wet sari around yourself and try again. For men, there's flatbread to provide cover for reinvention. Sure, bread rises softly in its bowl, is a contained lively dome, but they don't call it the staff of life for nothing. Should call it the shaft of life. So cut dough into sticks and get them hard. Spear whichever biscuits you can. It's your barrel. Triple and 10 no. Triple chocolate decadent cake includes a pouch with real chocolate chunks and rich fudge, so you can bake an over-the-top cake all with one box. Contains zero trans fats and no hydrogenated oils. And always means two. And always means two. Two always means two things, and always. This is the transitive property and is something you can always learn in elementary school if you attend Cake Eater Elementary, where my sons are schooled in the extortionate entitlement of early childhood with its ceaseless replenishment of decadent supplies, its over-the-top pencil pouches loomed and silkscreened by giant captive machines, squealing and coughing out zippered neon panoramas of the cartoon bear pantheon, perfect products bound for scuff and smear and doom. My sons leave hydrogenated chocolate drops in all their pouches' corners, leave them to bake at room temperature. The drops lose their structural integrity. They slumped softly into unwashable turds. This is to say nothing of the pencils themselves, plucked by the bunched fistful from their box of manufacture, destined to rot point-first encrusted fudge. The wood of them grows waxy with oils, turning dark and rich as the chocolate and trans fats of their ruin. In the wake of such treatment, a pencil cannot sharpen properly. Whether twisted and turned in the barrel of a planetary parer, or jammed into an electric advancement of the same, the wood falls from the graphite in moistened chunks, as if grown soft and real as a cake. And what of an eraser, feckless pink thing, one each to a pouch? No small human hand contains the faultless parallelograms of them. In lieu, my sons rub the buttery ends of their destroyed pencils over their mistakes, raising nothing but drawing much attention to the backwards B's, the sinking P's caught in steerage between an upper and lower case. The greasy mist makes a grisaille of each ditto sheet. 000 word score. And yet, great effort, bugles the scented emblazon, affixed to both homeworks. Effort is the move. Move we do, to the car, the store, the aisle, the pouches, to the register and the door, which includes a sensor that rewards us for the effort of walking up to it, and slides open noiselessly, so as to let us out into the open air.
Sign, James D'Agostino. Each day, 4 pounds of sunlight fall on the earth. Make a few calls. Try for an ounce, but whatever. Early morning ants shine, two-way traffic, back, sweet with found rot, and out, and in between, teach each other further, farther sugars. Here's the name of the city. Put it in your mouth. Girl with a bag of letters ladders up to the Englert marquee barefoot and takes out an M. Like the alphabet, the first ideas for women's shoes were birds. Lately, waves of geese at night look white, underlit with streetlight. Of course, it could have been a W. Make what you want of this. To code means we have to cut skylights. James D'Agostino. Here in the mile-wide swath, pinched in between don't hurt bad and don't feel too good, either A, the heart's a bowling alley, and I'm just another guy with four shoes, or I don't even want to think about B. What do you call that? It's just Tuesday. 7:50 or so, the sun solders its arc up above the oaks, so it's Squint City. It's writing with my eyes closed. It's fine. I can't see a thing in these sheets. Girls sip by, scissors dripping sunlit sorghum. But it's okay. B and seem to have worked all that shit out. Dragon flown, sunburnt, heat simmers birds to speak monkey. A street singer strings her trellis of trouble and peace. I figure all I've got to do is describe every face, and then we'll all be in here. Watch your head. James D'Agostino. If we lived our lives like songs, I'd drink strangely and much and most of the night until frost on the windshields, a dust of finely grated streetlight, spilled talc of zinc and moon, and one long walk home. And right about the time Y shoots way out ahead of how I feel, I will say no more of this, though very much else. Like, I like my blues with more green than yellow, too. I like cuckoo. I go ape. I've owned many kites and flown only most of them. How long have I had to get out of here? We're talking 10 or 12 minutes until the sun goes purple blowtorch, cooled to scrap-grade daylight. We're talking breakfast. That red freckle of storm on Jupiter has spun for 300 years. Roughly since Rousseau wrote the one rule of education's not to save time, but to squander it. Know about this. Due to weather, class is canceled.
My name is Brandon Holmquist, and this is a recording of Apparent Story 1 by Gaston Fernandez. There are palm trees in the hotel dining room in Rio. Midday, he's just arrived. Three on each broad side of the table, one of them him, one on each end. There are 8 of us. I don't like palm trees. Do you like music? Sometimes, once in a while, I feel like nothing's happened. Eyes closed, a feeling as of floating, or having already floated in the shadows and being sure of having known caverns in the air. There's a photographic machine on the Colombian's bed. He's a kid, they say. Do we get to see him? Known dark caverns in the air. Waiting on Hugo, who has his back turned, wearing a thin white shirt and a dark sweater with buttons, and his eyes are large, black, and sad very quickly. I haven't paid attention to him. In Rio, I think I see a last image, a photographic machine on the bed, remembering the wooden castle in Prague we'll invade at year's end, or the fogged photos that I'll take in Bruges. I dropped it many times, and he laughed. Do you like the music? We thought it was a 3-story house in Place La Douze. I was killing mosquitoes. Where we lived above him there, after all these staircases, and then me, more distant, but I came back every morning to see him, and we saw each other, and we talked, and we extended to one another the black hand of Christoph. Christ up there with his arms extended. Up. There's an eternal, mutual silence, penetrating and grave on the road downhill, and we sat down at 4 in the afternoon to have spaghetti and tomato sauce for lunch. He doesn't eat. He says he doesn't eat. He says that to me, and watches me eat. Hugo. There are 3 hands, the soil and sap of 3 pink flowers, on a bus, with muddy shoes and initials on a board. We went into the Musée d'Art and came out laughing with Henriette, not Charlotte, and we go on laughing in front of a little sideways painting by Dead Manolo, Betty Boops. It seems like we can hear music at 5 and we cross Africa reading informative bulletins, then nothing. Nothing. We're in the belly of the white whale, and we went up to a 3-story house to extend the black hand of Christoph. There's Christ, with his arms extended, up there, and there are 3 hands, the soil and sap of 3 pink flowers on a bus. Place La Douze. We're in a 3-story house. Jean Cotte, Le Figaro Littéraire. Christoph is here. Hugo's portable radio and the grain of his face, Les Inscriptions. Then we begin to live deeply. Wear the black one. It looks better and it's more restrained. I realized he was listening to me. He didn't know I was listening to him. Every day, the slow, rhythmic brushing of the black cloth on his arm against the black cloth on his hip told me that he'd already come. 3 soft blows, spaced out. One day I didn't want to open, but I opened. It was just before the return and after Prague, and he had seen the light under my door. We looked at the toothless girl from the pâtissier. Once in a while, we directed our eyes and steps toward the poor cavern behind her closed lips. I think she loved us in silence and without asking herself why. And we saluted Blanca of the dirty mouth. One day, when the afternoon's leaden gray and the smooth song of the winds began, toasted leaves fell from behind windows and formed beds. Then water fell and formed puddles, and the winds ran and formed fugitive strands of hair. We ate and drank of them in silence. We also ate meat and drank colored milks in silence. I think everyone loved without knowing where. He read to me sometimes, like parents, to put their children to sleep, tell them enchanted stories, and I listened, as if from far away. Rio is behind me. I feel it run over my kidneys and how I bind them with their flowing, rigid chain of lead, inviting me to the slow voyage of death, like all of you, beings. One night, while we slept, snow soundlessly fell and formed a white lawn for the first time. Saturday, the 12th of February, the sun came up at 5. It hasn't snowed since Sunday in Attigny. He didn't know what I did that Sunday, after a Saturday of classes. At 8 in the morning, it had snowed lightly all night for the first time. GF on the roofs of all the slumbering cars, on all the sleeping windshields and windows. Memories of a childhood had in fragments. Important happenings. Not a soul in Attigny. Waiting to run into some damsel in distress. Slow, silent march. Something similar to a forest or a private estate. A castle among the trees. A sharp silence. A scream, a rifle, a shot, blood on my back, then nothing. In La Guerre, waiting for the train, distracted reading, sudden and subconscious remembering of the time, the train in front of me, paper and pencil. All in 4 hours with light snow for the first time. He'd be sleeping at this hour, white over a white sheet and under a white sheet, a dark brown Ruana at his feet, in a jumble of books, Kandinsky to the left, Bruegel to the right, clean sheets for 25 francs. Saturday, the 12th of February, the sun came up at 5. It hasn't snowed since Sunday in Attigny. Saturday, 12th of February, the sun came up at 5, I tell you. It hasn't snowed since Sunday in Attigny. Saturday, the 12th of February, the sun came up at 5. It hasn't snowed since Sunday in Attigny. It snowed a lot, and it fell over our white shoulders and wept while she wrote her first letter on a thick white envelope. Tout ça, vraiment je t'aime. It snowed a lot. I wonder if this developed on the surface, since it seemed that we'd let ourselves fall soundlessly into an endless, dark, slow depth like a ship in the night that moves smoothly and without speaking. We fell with our bodies weightless. That night, the lights on the tables went out and two Egyptian handclaps brought forth 6 slaves carrying illuminated golden fountains, who came in through sideways doors to feed the hungry, quench the thirsty, clothe the naked. Endless, dark, slow. Do you hear music at 5? Undefined, lukewarm. Falling into endless depths, without memory, dark, slow, it seems at some moment the night's velocity and the wind moistened his eyes. Music was heard at 5, imperceptible, vague, ethereal, made of long phrases that repeated and ended, making a strange and mysterious alliance with the density of our temples and the silent murmur of air. He smoked. Music was heard at 5. A fantasia. I think we had listened to it before someplace. I don't remember where. Maybe in my house 2 years later. It was the same feeling of calm, a neutral hour, weightlessness. We wore shorts on account of the heat, those shorts we thought were bathing suits, white socks and slippers. We were enormously bored. One slept in dark glasses, took notes. The air was heavy. And there was a long corridor that ended in the little dining room, and on the side a door that opened on the big dining room. First they told us tie required, but we went without ties. They rang golden, vertical bells, whose sound continued in the air a while and then disappeared. Then we got up slowly, and we ate. We never went in the bar. I sat with Marie-Ange, who taught me to draw dogs with no tails. Then her mother appeared, and she disappeared with her. I remember it was the first time I was able to converse with someone seriously. She was very beautiful. I think once she called me by my name and once the night wind moistened my eyes. Then nothing. It must have been 6 years ago. We also thought of writing a book, The Anthology of Smell. It expanded slowly in streets and armpits, in dining rooms, slowly, and in cinemas, slipped through windows, eyes, door jams, invaded salons and souls, trains, and raised itself in holocaust to the skies where birds slumber. It passed beside us and lived with us. We never thought our laughter would die so cruelly, cut off by the snow. Then we visited empty Chinese exhibitions where Kang Mi, daughter of Ho, awaited us. and she never ceased to teach us how to unmask men. Then we talked, we talked, we talked, and we listened to the board bells at the library fall and roll, and we drank ink noon and night, and we did nothing but begin, every day, to live deeply. I traveled with a black umbrella. I talked to him. I knew the languages of Babel, the towers and arches, the plazas, the fields, four Vikings, temples and seas, night during day and women smoking pipes. I also made friends on the train with an Englishman and a dog who licked imaginary wounds from my left hand, the most beautiful one I have. Sitting on a colorless sofa, a blonde hair brushed my thigh with modest audacity, and we drank silence and hot spiced wine in the shadows. I met Noel in Paris and further on Graves under a white lawn. I saw Bruegel and Bach as children, and I spoke to her at length while crossing the park in a hurry, remembering parties that we by no means wanted to remember, when she shone with the brilliance in her eyes and I was holy. Do you remember me? My name is Somnus, son of anguish and memory, grandson of life. The old man who invited us to share his lonely table said this to Christiane and I, in Prague, a little later, New Year's night. He had a pink piglet in his arms that he had to touch to live. He said nothing more since he left us alone, though he didn't move from his place. Christiane bit her nails and wore a pink sweater and died a little every day. She didn't speak, and the day she died most was the night that train took us to Prague, all standing, very close together in the long corridor, all standing, very close together. No one spoke. He didn't speak. There were no free compartments. Guy no longer served for our jokes. Maybe we were sitting or standing on him without realizing it. Nicole. As the sun came up, we found free compartments. Their occupants disappeared like invisible gnomes in the night's cold. Hugo was chosen king. When we got off in Leuven, there was autumn sun in January, and we carried Modigliani under a black umbrella. I always think I remember that we walked in the yellow, phantasmagoric clarity of the streets at night, and that our faces turned pale, like theatrical masks, like the paleness of coming death, and that we went to the Vita. I think one night I seemed to stay behind while he spoke with her. It was the month of January. I seemed to end the night on the summit of some white rocks in the park, listening, whistles below, on the road, veiled by the waters. My eyes seemed to hear that we always get an F for effort, and we spend whole centuries in Marienbad. Then we come back to Earth, which rejects us, and we suffer much without knowing where. It says to us, from far away, Vous êtes comme un ombre, et vous attendez que je m'approche. It was only later that we died. Dateline Lima, October 1968, dedicated to Eduardo López Jaramillo.
The Money Shot, Ricardo Maldonado. The money shot persists as penalty asked for. This case of oneself to another is resurrected with coffee. Except he blessed daybreak, and he has seen my face fear the end because he prayed it wouldn't be safe to place a name for it when the Marlboros were tossed, because they implicated expiration at year's end, because he neglected to access select start, and the barrows exist, if marked by limit, if there is limit, if he would comprehend there was much to endorse inside the walk-up when I read without mercy. Must be every city exists, if the limit could tame the earth, if the limit could fail but breed excuses to ensure a kind of heresy, and be more of a result of meaning, when he walked to the door without mystery. At least we could refuse the name, because we made residence and means to wait, because the express left, and the first penalty, at 11, was called our exile. For love, Ricardo Alberto Maldonado. For love. Already there appears a pattern of disorder on the floor, myths of impenitence and speculation that every X is reason for the vodka and a bag of peanuts. Is want yet to relinquish when we approached with navy slacks and metaphysics and invested that 30s talkies with vodka. Quoth vices and the stewards, quoth tomorrow's Alka-Seltzer. We walked to the lavatory for self-examination and discreet shampooing. sleet on tarmacs, and the concourse cancels out my sense of others with a second round. 3:30 seems compelling, if a little improbable, when we do outreach. I know each other from each other to start the beautiful humiliation differently. Sleet, jets, dark, intensely urgent with their mystery, this sense of others we take with vodka and a violence of which there is enough in us to concern us. I am going to him, and he will not come back to me would seem pleasurable, but for the precedent on television, hungry for food, and pertinently bearable. Love Seat by Arrest, Ricardo Alberto Maldonado. Love Seat by Arrest. Wednesday's shower was of two minds, prohibition era scald and glacial. We incur lapse payment for the lease when the egg cartons cohere in spare arrangement, quick yolk replenishing linoleum tile, replete with wet investments, knitwear, tartan beefsteaks in a surplus. That manhood quits in private and in films with apologias of the dying middle class, and retreats by fire escape where small amounts of smokers seize a peace by spirit switch in the space of habitation. Minor-chested courage tapering midweek over formica and black leather. The units stand irresolute at still and are caressed by pigeon shit. Could seize the city and repost negotiations with the asphalt and the living, who approach with liberal measures of inside time, civic fealty, and the charm of insect bite and influenza, as we ready the body for the young to desert with its insipid dental habits, and the mice enters the apartment, as we would conquer it with panic, and runners attire of orange elastine. Lay away, Ricardo Alberto Maldonado. Lay away. We were acquiesced to the crimes of our disloyalties and slack exchanges. Look. My life is not what I like it to be. This year, mornings imply an act of bravery. We are figuring what it might be like to live knowing intimates and conflicts with size. Look, we could prove what we have yet to disgrace. Look, the window displays are changing. All the males have made it and move on in the city's red gloss. Heterosexuality as custom. Ricardo Alberto Maldonado. Heterosexuality as custom. A sense of men's privacy and what they may have hidden when they remain an indeterminate age with meals and extravagant uniforms. They recede in a calming way before men breach, before men resign the chance to tender their love of human history, as if they were exhausted by desire. In the dangerous ceremony of male love, and use an inside voice when activity begins, each search accompanied by sleeplessness, drink, and of course the addictive life, with different contingencies for the commute. Peace, peace, Mercutio, peace, thou talk'st of men's urgency and absolute diligence, men consumed by enmity and what they are meant to retrieve, the milk now set to expiration.
A quick lesson in grammar. Lying is when you told me you don't have a lover. Laying takes a subject and object and can be sexual. Your lover laid you while you lay in his bed, lying to me. In this case, he is the subject and you are the object. Either way, you got laid. Which is slightly different than what happened in our matrimonial bed, where I was often lying awake, waiting for your late returns, while wondering if you were in an accident and lay bleeding on the freeway. You weren't. Sometimes people say they were laying on the beach, which is wrong, unless they were having sex on the beach, which is also a fruity drink ordered in bars. This is true. I wouldn't lie to you. But most people merely lie on the beach, which I believe you did with him several times. Please tell me you didn't lay him on the beach, because while we often lay on the beach, we never laid on the beach, which I regret. Speaking of regrets, I wish, which means now we're in the subjunctive, you would have lied to me your whole life, so you could have lain with me for eternity, or at least until death.
This is the story of how I got sober without naming names like a chump. By Kate Weiss. Don't understand the idea of redemption. Waste of time thinking about that. Waste of time, too, that night you, in the Patriot's hat, and I sat at the bar, mapped out how I knew life got me drunk. You never expected I'd have to get sober. You circled around me like a dog flattening grass, plodding his way to lie down. Lie better, an indictment you'd yet to shout, your voice yet to squeeze through the hole in my door. Lie better, lie quiet, lie low. Sex was the check at the end of an evening, expected, but hardly split fair. Damn, we weren't happy. But we were something, all right. Tumbling fresh, running drunk, they'd yet to teach me the lingua recovery at church basement meetings, my hands yet to stroke those cheap plastic coins. 24 hours comes hard, but it comes. Today it's just seltzer. When we divvy up tabs now, we don't have to get naked. And waters from wines an unmiracalized Christ. So we weren't happy. Black smoke of tail blaze trailing, but damn, we were something, all right. Two raging beings on a spiral from heaven, spewing rank starlight from sky. The Whole Ending by Kate Weiss. This hunger is more mouth than stomach. I will have no one to talk to. Once you're gone, roll the stone back up inside me. Pour concrete, seal the breach. If the angel'd only told me the whole story, the whole ending, up atop that glorious hill, I would have calcified that embryo, set to stone and froze this life, this you, flint of God. Inside. You cover the walls with maps, strange child cities plastered, while you gestate proof, son of whitewashed womb. God, I am your mother. I am the husk you once called home, the shriveled cord that kept you human, now unbound. I am just one of three who waits.
Bleach by Kate Click. Number 1. Claire Mays, March 9, 1967 to October 14, 1997. Graduate teaching assistant at University of Texas at Dallas, she is survived by her husband, Glenn Mays, her two sons, Brandon, 18, Matthew, 10, and her daughter, Lindsay, 6. Number 2. I'm 6 years old peeling bark off an oak tree. My best friend Lindsay sprawls out over a sun-bleached map of the United States painted on the blacktop, her honey hair burning into the cement. She rolls over Texas and Oklahoma and muses about animal crackers in the sky. I put the bark in my pockets. My overalls are covered with dried chocolate milk and grass stains. Mama will be mad. Lindsay's mom is picking us up today for our weekly play date, but she is late, late, late. I watch the sun seep over the sea of brick houses and oversized Texas flags. It must be 4 o'clock. The sun always looks like a pricked fried egg at 4. The teacher with the hairy upper lip barks at us. Who is picking you girls up? It is late, 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 and I have a bingo game. We are scared of this woman. She is the only teacher to throw balls during dodgeball. She always picks the overly pumped orange ones. She smells like pickles. Mrs. Mays does not come. The clouds are turning purple and cleaning up the runny egg in the sky. It is 5 o'clock. Teacher must have called my mom because I see her roly-poly van. We climb in the back seat, wiping our clammy hands on the fading blue fabric. I pull the bark from my overall pockets and put it in the cup holder under my sticker collection. Mama will never find it. Lindsay asks why her mom didn't come. I see my mother's chestnut hair turn to gray as she pulls the van over, throwing us forward into the back pockets of the bucket seats, maps and magazines poking our salty faces. Lindsay rubs the hurt off her forehead. I see Mama cry for the first time. Number 3. Lindsay and I were baptized with bleach and placed in thickly insulated bubbles of piety. We lived subject to a faith with no gray area, a faith that left no room for spots. We weren't allowed to believe in the tooth fairy. We couldn't celebrate Halloween or listen to non-Christian music. If we were good enough, God would save up treasures in heaven for us, and if we were bad, we would suffer the consequences. The God we came to know was the love child of Santa and Zeus. He was all-powerful and all-knowing, a God with a white beard and fistful of coal and lightning bolts. We revered him with all we had, but our reverence was birthed from an all-consuming fear. He knew we stole the glitter pencils from Mrs. Smith's desk. He knew we cheated on number 3 of our spelling test. He knew we practiced saying bad words in Lindsay's closet when we were supposed to be asleep. All we knew was that we would be punished. So we waited. Every day we waited for the whip of the God Almighty until one day it came. Under a blaring red light and a set of shoddy brakes, he fulfilled his wrath. Our 18-wheeler killer God, our ambulance too late guide, our peach pit and the throat God, he brought us to our knees. We never questioned her death because we believed in our visceral souls that it was our fault. God was simply giving us the receipt for our sins. We, with our endless list of unforgivable iniquities, pre-dinner cake stuck in our pigtails, killed her. When I was 13, I stopped writing letters to the Santa Claus God. I found a new God and a new zip code. Goodbye, bloody son. Goodbye, Lindsay. Hello, rock and roll. Number 4. Mama is holding a toothbrush in one hand and a bucket of bleach in the other. She's talking at me, so I won't notice she is crying again. The floors are just so filthy, I don't know why you bring those doggone cleats into the kitchen after I've repeatedly told you not to. Hiccup. I say I am sorry and run to get my toothbrush. I'm going to make her laugh. I am dancing and yodeling and beating my chest with my cowboy toothbrush. Mom, look what I have! My feet catch a wet tile of linoleum and I am flying. When I open my eyes, my mama's face is a strawberry crying. I think she'll be mad at me for running in the house, but she reaches for me instead. I curl up in her lap on the kitchen floor. The bleach is so close to my face that my eyes are blooming tears. She whispers a prayer. Mama's knees have little white diamonds in them that match the tile. She is shaking like she's cold, but beads of sweat crown her forehead. We go to the living room, and she paints my nails and gets the baby pink polish all over my skin, but I don't tell her. She looks happy. Daddy calls, and he tells me it is snowing where he is. I miss him, but I know I don't miss him as much as Mama does. I think that must be why she shivers so much lately. She just loves him so much that she wants it to be snowing here, too. I have never seen snow. I write about this in my diary tonight next to a magazine cutout of a snowman. Number 5. 2 summers of popsicle chins and monkey grass safaris after Mrs. Mays died, Lindsay and I turned death into an elaborate joke. Backyard murder mysteries and fatal Barbie car crashes, we laughed at the Reaper Grimm. Lindsay faked her death on the living room carpet for every nanny who tried to unpack their suitcase or bat their eyelashes at her Superman father. A heart attack mysteriously seized Lindsay on the right side of her chest. A bloodbath of ketchup dripped from her temple. There was no end in sight for our well of deafening laughter. If death was a joke, we could never see it as fear. Shoveling dirt over death's grave, we buried him deep with a cackle and a snort. But we were not deaf to his rattle. Number 6. I see now it was fear that kept me small. Not the God I cowered beneath, not even the jarring realization of death. I lived a quaking nightmare, acutely aware of the unavoidable darkness that would meet me. Somewhere between the folds of my brain and the crevices of my heart, there was a searing stamp of disapproval. I could not hide from this fear. I was God's red-headed stepchild. And it wasn't just Mrs. May's death that proved my suspicion. I could stain everything good. My bony fingers always dipped in soot. There was, and still is, something that stirred violently inside of me, wanting to do bad. My mother once told me that she envied me for being little. She said, if you're small, the smoke that rises to blind men from goodness can never reach your eyes. Stay small, little one, and death will never find you. Number 7. It broke my heart to learn your home was not in the clouds, the heavenly host of marshmallow bolsters that the architect in me so loved to see. It was easier to understand you in the shape of a superglued cross than to see salvation in a heap of metal, to hear your voice in a low autumn sigh, to feel grace in the lock of hair dancing between my eyelashes. God of the battered, used, and bothered, you are much closer than the lofty pulpit. In every grain of sand, every speck of dust, gold, and cotton sifted, you are there. When my burning heart sings at the rushing of the water and the smoke rises high in front of my firecracker eyes, you kneel to meet me. Alabaster jar trembling in my hands. You are deeper than my mother's well of tears, more infallible than death. You are bigger than fear.
To Carter by Elizabeth Mayer. Lady, I thought of you today and how you always liked a good fountain soda. On 1,000-mile road trips, we'd drive through drive-thrus in your mother's silver Subaru, the one with the black leather heated seats, and you'd get a Coke and I'd get a coffee. Hey, remember that time on the way to Chillicothe when we missed our exit and nearly ended up in Wisconsin? It smelled like snow that night in June as you craned your neck toward the orange-vested toll collector. She laughed at us as we turned around and drove south through the whole state of Illinois. I felt like I was hallucinating the reflectors on the double yellows on the way to that weird motel where we finally stopped. In the morning, Illinois was gold and flat and full of corn. I thought it looked so boring and missed Virginia with its peaks and valleys and beaches. And I felt so landlocked and somehow nervous to be so far from the sea, the same reason you once said you could never live in New Mexico. Then I said, who needed the sea with all that sky? But now I know different because, though you did not stay, I can't help but remain here in my home. Virginia.
One makes of noise a ladder. One makes of noise a ladder. One climbs through the hole of noise. Inside the hole of noise is the whole of noise. Every part contains its everything. The able men with their shooting percentages contain the bodies of all the boys they fucked when they were boys. The cavernous mouths of infants clog with tumors. Blue eyes on the radiator, brown eyes on the floor. Every house contains one's family, the size and shape of any possible house. One must only look in the garage to find all the mothers and fathers of the world lined up, patiently waiting to paint clouds in the nursery. The body. One might ask a child, where is your twin? Where is your mirror image? The child would answer, there is no twin. I am my own mirror image. The caretaker. One must take care of the severed heads piled in the center of the church. People do not want their heads, after they are dead, to rot. The flowers may wither and the oaks attract the flame, but a head is a head for as long as it stays free of rot. When the severed heads speak, they often say things like, thanks, dude. Only rarely does one find an ungracious severed head. They whine, where is my breath? Where are those who promise to remember me? Some of the caretakers put things in the mouths of the ungracious severed heads. Muscle relaxers, a single long black hair, their dicks. But one should maintain composure. It is difficult to be a severed head, blinking constantly over drying and then dried eyes, tourists poking at the distended tongue, flashing snapshots like tiger stripes. At night, after the church closes and the neon lights have chilled, one must take the softest brush to each head individually. One must cradle the severed head in one hand, resting it on one's knees, look closely at every part of it, searching for the rot that inevitably will appear. The cave. Animals seek refuge in the cave that occurs in one's body. One may wake with a raccoon there, or 10,000s of bats, one may see 3 deer humping a sawhorse by the light of the full moon. What one knows depends on what one can see. For instance, one can see a woman in a black hoodie, or one can see the IV emerging from one's arm and the other IV emerging from the veiny back of one's hand. Then one knows the hoodie, the IVs. When one enters the cave that occurs within one, one becomes the animal one knows how to be. The Quiet American. One picks through the trash for flattened cans and bits of copper wire. Water drips from the malarial eyes of computer screens onto the discarded plastics below. There is always white smoke of flaming plastic, always one's brothers and sisters twisting new contortions to reach below the heaps of trash. Mothers and fathers merge into a bit of black garbage bag flapping in the wind. Language fades in the sun. One thinks one is above this, but there is nothing above this. The world is a trash heap, the occupants searching through the smoke and carcasses.